We sometimes throw our hands up at the word political, as if it's a dirty word, something beneath us. To many, it means that we are blind partisans, and people are right to lament the definition of political that means partisan. But for the ancients, human beings just are political by nature, and that doesn't mean they are partisans by nature. Tonight I want to do two things. First, I want to highlight this difficulty we have right now between distinguishing politics from our political nature. Second, I want to turn back the clock. I think MIT is trying to figure out how you can do that. I'm going to try to do that in my way. I want to turn back the clock to the 5th century, about the time another new synthesis was being formed in the West with Augustine's City of God, and I'll talk about that in the second half of the talk. By the end, I hope the ancient will help us better understand the modern and maybe even help us to think about what comes after. If you look at what makes us different from other animals, as I'm sure you have, you'll surely look to interior realities like intellect and will, or the immediate exteriorization in language and action. But after that, if you look at the world from space, you'll notice that we are the only animals who build cities. We are, of course, social by nature, as other animals are, but we are uniquely political by nature. It seems quite a simple observation, but if we can recognize that we are political by nature, what does that have to do with the political lives we live? Politics today seems like something out of a comic book, with battling teams that seem locked into a mutual death spiral, and we all pay to watch. Well, if we don't pay, we log in, and advertisers pick up our money as we watch. It's more marked by mutual hatreds, ad hominem attacks, perpetual partisan tribalism than by any substantive account of common goods or even common political knowledge. Politics is more likely to divide friends and families than to unite them. A few years back, we had massive debates about borders, you'll remember, not simply because of mass migration, but also because nations around the world have been having a similar kind of crisis of identity. In France, in England, in our country, the people are restless, no longer confident of who they are. What is their political nature? Such anxieties tap more deeply into us than we know. Even as we witness micro-identity politics at home all over the world, we're witnessing a kind of macro-identity crisis, the world cracking up over basic goods and forms. What does it mean to be a nation? What does it mean to be a people? What holds us together? Do we have a common history, a common way of life, a common good? Or incredibly, some even ask if we have a common nature. We are suddenly worried about our answers to questions that we long thought had been answered. Many have observed that we are in the midst of a massive realignment of Western political order, and that America is important to understanding this, and Christianity, I would say, is also important to understanding our present shifts. At least since the 19th century, theorists have been predicting total secularization of the world, a slow-motion divorce of God and the West. We have seen some evidence of secularizing trends, some which detach us from the church, some which detach us from nature, some which detach us from God, and of course, all of us see trends which have worked to detach us from each other. Our political polarization is thus an effect of a profound crack-up, fragmentation. Pierre Menant, arguably the greatest living political philosopher working in any language, has been arguing for years that one of the most fundamental problems that faces us now is that we are political animals who have built political orders which increasingly detach us from our political nature. I'll say that again. We are political animals who have built political orders that increasingly detach us from our political nature. As I noted from the outset, this might seem counterintuitive since we associate being political with holding strong partisan views and disagreeing with each other, having political identities and pitting those against other political identities. Political campaigns give evidence of this. Women for candidate X, Hispanics for candidate Z, Catholics for X or Y, evangelicals for X or Y. This has become the standard campaign pattern. Identity then becomes, as David Brooks recently pointed out, centrifugal rather than centripetal. We are all constantly being forced apart by our politics at ever-increasing extremes. This is not, in fact, what Pierre Menant means by our political nature, as you might imagine, even if it tells us something important. Having a political nature means for him that human beings, as human beings, we have a basic ordering, a structure to being the kind of animals that we are, that is not simply ordered to our own good, but we have an ordering to common goods. And that if we have an ordering to common goods, it follows that one can abstract from that to their perfection terms, to highest possible goods, and even to a good which is beyond all things in its goodness, which you could call God. But if being political is something which can be predicated of our nature rather than to this or that desire I have as an individual, if being political is something common to us all by virtue of simply existing, if it names our essential need to enter into agreements about goods we all share and have need of, then what damage is being done to our nature by our politics? I would put to you that our present political life is not just humans being political, but is a denial of our political nature. For our political nature is increasingly being denied its proper expression. Instead of the common thing, what the classical thinkers will think about as the res publica, the public thing. Instead of the public thing, we're descending into fake tribes. We want the common thing, but we don't have the real common thing. We merely operate in the category of will, in the category of individual desire, and then we collect consent by way of power while denying anything good prior to us. Maybe you've seen these graphs showing how everyone now lives in partisan bubbles. Maybe we're in one now. But these are, in fact, evidence of people who are not partisan by nature, but who are people who are political by nature, who have real common goods that they have not recognized, but they have been detached from. If you are detached from goods which are common to you by nature, you will not pursue the highest goods of your nature. And if you don't pursue the highest goods of your nature or the perfection of those goods, you can imagine that your polis is going to sink. If you're not pursuing common goods, you will also not be inclined to pursue the highest good, the summum bonum. This is where I find Menant so helpful. He says that the Western dynamic, this is what he calls what we're in, the Western dynamic. The Western dynamic begins and ends with the city. Athens, Rome are the archetypes. Menant writes, "The city is the shaping of human life that made the common thing, that made the government of the common thing and the execution of the common thing in a plurality of cities. The form which succeeded the city was the empire, and the form which succeeded empire was the nation. But each of these political forms belong to a single movement of history which corresponds to our political nature." That is to say, Menant thinks that the history of classical political thought conforms to political nature better than our current arrangements. A certain trend detaches us from our political nature, and this is what he wants to recover. In a sense, he also, like me, wants to return to the ancient to heal the modern. This tendency of factional desires that tend to detach us from the dignity of our political nature, he calls the anti-political tendency. Our politics are anti-political. That's his basic thesis. This is what Menant writes about this distinction. The ancient political condition is oriented to the question of who participates in the common thing. Not all are welcome, but who participates in the common thing, which is inseparable from the more radical question, what is the common thing? A metaphysical question, even, that we might not be allowed to ask. Manon says that the modern anti-political has not superseded the ancient. Rather, the ancient arrangement is still present, effective, and active among our modern configurations. It's not, here's the ancient over here, here's the modern. We still, in a sense, live off the fumes. We will still talk and yearn for a common good, precisely because this is the ancient that's working and is effective and is active beneath the modern. Aristotle once said, "The city in which the people do not participate is not a true city. The good city educates the people who are capable of sharing in the life of the city." But our modern state no longer conceives of itself this way. When this happens, it is inevitable that our polities degrade. The Federalist Papers actually seem to know this too. Madison wrote, "There can be no cure for the mischief faction." Furthermore, Madison wrote, "There's a great difference between a democracy and a republic." Madison had the basic idea too, that there was a factionalism in democracy which could be easily detachable from the metaphysical grounding of a res publica. Now, a republic can break down into factional democracy, or like Rome, it can break down into a kind of Caesarism. But both breakdowns are a failure to unite political nature, our political natures, to a consideration of what really is the common good. What is nature? And what is the highest good to which natures ought to be ordered or are ordered? In either direction, we can see the breakdowns in our own political life, our failure to regard our neighbor is an index of our failure to regard God. Now, for Aristotle, the city of Athens aimed at the highest good. It embraced all of our loves. It was the comprehensive instantiation of the highest good. Athens was the highest good, in a sense. Similarly, for Cicero's Rome, everything from the household all the way up should be on a proper scale comprehended by the city. For the classical mind, the city is the comprehensive good, the highest good. For this reason, and others, Manon admires the Aristotelian and the Platonic, but he strangely calls Cicero the first modern, just to screw up with your genealogy. Cicero is the first modern. Why does he think Cicero is the first modern? Because Cicero proposed a new view of republican government, one which has a duty of guaranteeing rights and the protection of property. This shifts us to thinking about the individual as a rights bearer who has possessions, right? Not dissimilar from how Hobbes and Locke will think about these things. In Manon's view, this sows the seed of the modern state that runs on individualism and leaves little place for the true common good. Where Aristotle had subtle ways of talking about the full range of virtues and vices every human being was capable of, but little interest in individual particularity, desires, interests, Cicero made individual identity a key theme. Aristotle stressed our common nature. Cicero stressed our particular nature. In Manon's view, this detaches individual particularity from common nature and produces a modern anti-political strain in the Western dynamic. So this is also a fun argument because it gets you out of really tired genealogical declension narratives, because if Cicero's the first modern, you have to throw out all your stories about the Western dynamic and how it rises and falls. But it's a little bit of rhetorical play, but he has a point. Christianity, however, does change the scale. And that's what I want to talk about the rest of the evening. Christianity changes the basic scale. The basic scale on which Cicero, who's our modern, and Aristotle, who's our ancient in Manon's terms, gets changed, transfigured in a sense, in how the West thinks about categories like common nature, republics, friendships. And it also relativizes that notion that the city or the polis is the highest comprehensive good. Christianity will agree with Aristotle and Manon alike that human beings are social and political by nature. It will agree that we all share in a common nature. But Christianity also explains why politics can degrade and detach us from the common good in different ways. It has a different scale for explaining what would elevate or degrade our participation in the common good. It teaches us both why politics can pull us down a scale, as we're currently experiencing, and also it can tell us why a polity can be pulled up a scale. In this sense, Christianity can be said to give the West a deeper and a higher understanding of politics. Jesus tells the rabbis that they should render to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. He says to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." And in doing so, he reveals that earthly politics have limits, that there is something prior to them, and that there is something above them. The thinker who deserves most credit for developing the Christian scalar view, what I call the scalar view of politics, is St. Augustine, the 5th century Bishop of Hippo in North Africa. It's difficult to overstate his influence, of course, is the influence of Augustine's City of God, especially on the Western dynamic. It constitutes one of the most sustained critical arguments with the history, both ancient and modern, that is prior to Augustine. The classical, philosophical, moral, political, and religious traditions of the Roman world are, in a sense, the groundwork out of which he argues for a new vision of the res publica. Right? He provides a comprehensive account of what Christ reveals to us about the proper ordering of the world. It's a grand text spanning 1,100 pages over 22 books. It was written in response, as most of you, I hope, know, to the sack of Rome in 410. The sack of Rome in 410 was just a generation after Theodosius had made the empire Christian officially. Constantine had made Christianity an illicit religion, and Theodosius in 381 orders many of the pagan shrines to be crushed and declares Christianity the official religion of empire. So it's just 30 years after that that Rome falls, as it were, the first major fall. So it's hard on the heels, Augustine. It's hard on the heels of a new vision for the Western world. Augustine wrote at the request of a Roman official, a Roman proconsul for North Africa named Marcellinus, who reported that many Roman elites were blaming Christianity for the sack of Rome. They, like Julian the Apostate, couple generations prior, wanted to return Rome to the old gods. Augustine responded in his first 10 books by telling Romans their own story, in a sense telling them about their common history, telling them about their common philosophical traditions, their common religious traditions. Augustine responds by, in a sense, situating the current crisis in a bigger story. He showed how the old gods were bad for Rome, and whenever followed, the people were degraded by these false gods, by false ideas about who they were. All the blessings of Rome, rather, came from the providence of the one true God. And this also held for this life and eternal life. The benefits of this held for this present life and for eternal life. The old gods not only failed to bring about temporal benefits, as he puts it, but Rome's best philosophers were always restlessly moving towards some unarticulated or not quite well articulated monotheism, beyond the polytheism, precisely because they understood that the many gods were mere projections of anthropological origin, noble lies, as Plato put them. Augustine argued that the basic problem that Roman polytheism had was that it could not get Romans attached to the true good they wanted. It could not get them attached to the one true God because the errors blocked their way, put obstacles in their way to the true God. False gods merely served to disorder their moral and political lives as people because it put obstacles before their vision of the supreme good. In Book 10, he introduces, of course, Jesus Christ as the sacrifice, the one true sacrifice and mediator who can adhere us to the summum bonum. This sacrifice in which Christ becomes both the means of our attachment to the highest good and the end, the highest good, is both God and man, uniting us perfectly to God and to the good of one another, becomes, in a sense, the relativizing principle for the Western dynamic. Now you have a standard which has footing in this present world and in eternal life, which gives us a new standard for thinking about the Western dynamic, to stay with Manon's phrase. This point's going to become crucial later on as I talk about Augustine's critique of Cicero on a just republic in a few minutes. Books 11 through 22, I'm giving you an overview of the book so that I can make a few points on the way, but also because I expect that most of you haven't read the book. But books 11 through 22 proceed to tell Romans a greater story into which they may see themselves, namely the biblical story. Augustine tells the story of creation. He tells the story, if you will, of salvation history. He tells the story about the origins and histories and destinies of two distinct tendencies. You might even call them a political tendency and an anti-political tendency. Two distinct tendencies. One which pulls us towards the good, even the highest good. That would be a political tendency. And one which pulls us away from the highest good. One which you could say was anti-political, which draws us down. These two tendencies he sometimes calls metaphorically cities. One, an anti-political city and a political city. Augustine's following the distinction that Christ himself introduced, a distinction between those ordered to God and those whose own private ordering, privatio is to take away, their own privatio of the good detaches them from God, the wheat and the chaff, if you will. Often the two cities are also given biblical type, Jerusalem and Babylon. But most often when Augustine uses the two cities, what he's really talking about is an interior disposition of the soul towards God and man. In this way, I think Augustine's two cities are better described as interior dispositions that can be recognized in external acts. Now, this is my Augustinian Thomism coming out. Thomistic distinctions are ones usually drawn from Augustine. These interior dispositions can be recognized in external acts, and that's precisely what Augustine does with the whole history of the Bible, is he looks at what are the acts of the biblical history, and can we trace the two cities? This looks like this kind of city. This action looks like a degrading action, which is moving in this direction. This kind of action is Abel's action. His sacrifice is pleasing to God. Why? It moves in this kind of direction. The city of man, then, and the city of God are not two empirical cities. Rome is never identified as the city of man. Sometimes it's called the New Babylon, but don't let that worry you. The two cities have cosmic significance for Augustine as dispositions in the soul, and as with Plato, dispositions in the city and in the cosmos. On one level, God is the source for both cities. Nothing exists that was not brought into existence by God out of nothing. But the city of man finds its origin in the irrational and absurd, angelic and human turn away from God as the source and cause of our nature. The city of God is like a sickness visited upon our political nature. The city of man is a sickness visited upon our political nature. You can think of it as parasitic, as a second nature which pulls down the good of creation. It is a privation of the original right ordering, a privation of the good, made possible, how? By the will's private flight from truth, by the desire's private flight from wisdom, and an inward turn away from God that withdraws us from the common good and the highest good. By contrast, the city of God finds its origin in, first, a holy angelic community, and then in those human beings who seek justice and walk humbly with their God. One of Augustine's favorite images of the two cities is Cain and Abel, where the city of man might be thought of in terms of Cain as homicidal, where Cain murders his brother. And the city of God is like Abel, obedient, priestly, and lives sacrificially as an oblation before God. All the polarities, then, of Augustine's two cities follow from this primordial division stemming from the creation of rational beings and their prideful turn away from God as their cause. One city based on pride, the other humility. One deceives and flatters, the other seeks truth and understanding. One seeks to order all their loves to the self, and the other to God. One worships creation, the other the Creator. With such conceptual tools for distinguishing two cities, Augustine is then able to identify aspects of each city in Roman history, so that Roman history itself becomes a preambula fidei, a walking towards faith in which you can see aspects of both Cain and Abel. You can see aspects which are moving towards the good and those which are pulling us away from it. And this enables us to make good distinctions in history, to be good judges. Later in the City of God, Augustine will think of the Christian precisely in these terms, as a judge, someone who is now, by this new standard, able to judge rightly what is true and what is false, what is rightly ordered and what is wrongly ordered. It gives the Christian a new grasp of even political knowledge and political judgment. Consistently, he brings his analysis back to Jesus Christ, as you would expect, as the King of the City of God. Christ's kingdom is that city on pilgrimage, in his famous image. It is his mystical body united to the heavenly city by the sacrament of the altar, which stands as the source and the summit of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church proclaimed in the creeds. Augustine strongly identifies the church on earth with the city of God, but he's also aware of the presence of the city of man even in the life of the church. So just as he can see two cities in a shadow in the life of Rome, he can see the two cities even in the life of the church. He lambasts false Christians. He sounds like Pope Francis. He lambasts false Christians, false bishops, heretics, schismatics who bear false witness to Christ's body. These can be identified and discerned if you know how to distinguish the two cities. They cannot fundamentally threaten the essential unity, though, the church, Augustine thinks, because her unity is a gift which comes from above, guarded by the Holy Spirit himself as well as apostolic authority. This strong vision of the church as the city of God on pilgrimage renders the church now the most comprehensive order on earth only by virtue of it mirroring the most comprehensive city in the cosmos, the eternal heavenly city. This claim has political consequences for the Western dynamic. One consequence is that Augustine's scalar vision, which in a sense explodes the notion that the city is the highest good, and tells us that there's something prior to and above politics. At the same time, it changes the Western dynamic because it gives politics more dignity. Let me say more about that. While the scalar account gives something that's above politics and below politics, and so it limits the scope of politics, it also has a much thicker account of what politics is for in terms of the common good being united to that which is prior to it and that which is above it. Now the common good is, in a sense, part of a bigger cosmic story. He famously distinguishes that which is prior to the political by those first principles of our nature, metaphysics, if you will, and anthropological observations that were made rational, were made social, were made to multiply. And so politics are, for Augustine, those relationships which nature engenders and requires the creation of children through conjugal unions that are obtained in families. It generates the needs for peace between neighbors, between classes, between friends. And so the social facts of our nature generate a political need for a common thing. Human beings need each other socially, and that makes it so that we need each other politically. Thus, Augustine revises Aristotle's man is political by nature to something more like Aquinas' claim that man is social and political by nature. This creates a kind of threefold hierarchy of the social, the political, and the ecclesial, and sets up the basic presuppositions for medieval Christendom, and in a different way, our modern political arrangements too. For we also cannot get away from the idea that there's something social and political and religious about our polity. So now the Western story is penetrated with a new hierarchical account, but one which must return us to the question of republics and the relation to the church, common goods or public things in relationship to a highest common thing that has come from above in the city of God. The basic structure of the relationship between the church and politics in Augustine is most clearly and famously seen in his 19th book. Book 19, chapters 21 through 24 are the locus classicus for thinking about the church's relation to politics, and so everybody goes right there. In Book 19, he continues an argument that he began in Book 2, which had to do with Cicero's new definition of a commonwealth. Remember, Manant's kind of critical of the new definition, which he advances in the voice of Scipio. Cicero says that a commonwealth is united in association by a common sense of right, use, and a community of interest. Where he explains a common sense of right depends on justice. Justice, then, is the foundation of a commonwealth, since justice is that virtue which assigns everyone his due, and all rights flow from the fount of justice. You can hear in Cicero's definition some of what concerns Manant, right? Very rights-focused. And this is what Manant will call the modern republicanism. Augustine uses this argument to the church's advantage because he carefully shows that the Rome which he recalled in the first 10 books had not rendered what was due to God, and thus, because nobody could render what was due to God, and thus by Augustine's light failed to be a commonwealth as Cicero had defined it, because Cicero defined the republic as rendering to each his due. Well, if you can't render what is due to God, then on this definition, you don't get to be a republic. It's a kind of rhetorical trick. But he has a point. If you concede that there is one God, which Cicero might. Augustine uses the argument to the church's advantage. If Cicero demands that a republic is only constituted by rendering to each his due, and God isn't rendered what is due, only Caesar, then it really doesn't live up to its own definition of a republic without Christ as the one who can offer what is due. The justice which is owed to the true God can only be rendered by sacrifice, and the only sacrifice which could be acceptable to God would be a pure, perfect sacrifice which only he could offer. In fact, by uniting humanity to himself in the incarnation of his Son, Christ has become the sacrifice which is due to God. In this way, Augustine shows that only the one holy Catholic and apostolic church renders justice to God. And if only the church renders true justice to God, well then, only the church can make the truly comprehensive commonwealth claim which can unite the Roman Republic, right? Only the church as a societas perfecta can be the thing which holds Rome together against the pagan concerns that Christianity is weakening Rome. His argument is that it's the only thing that can provide it the coherence it so badly wants. The great triumph of Augustine's argument is to take a profoundly Roman idea here about commonwealth, about res publica, and show that the proper terminus of their own claims can only be fulfilled by an order which is in, but not of, this world. That is to say, the church herself is the source and summit of justice. The church is the source and summit of the true commonwealth because it's constituted by Christ crucified, who alone renders what is due to God, namely justice from us to him. With this comprehensive claim established, Augustine has denied Rome the status of a commonwealth, though. Right? That's on Cicero's definition. If Cicero if we're failing to give everybody their due, including God, then we don't get to be a commonwealth, then Rome is clearly failing. But Augustine recognizes that Rome clearly is a commonwealth, so this can't be. Rome clearly is a commonwealth, so he needs an alternative definition. He says on Cicero's very strict definition of what a commonwealth is, Rome isn't a commonwealth. But if you have a more modest, more limited account of what a res publica is, you actually are a commonwealth. And so, by way of Cicero, he offers a more moderate definition of a commonwealth by which we can think of commonwealths on a scale of better and worse. This is crucial. Having taken away the Ciceronian definition, reserved it for the church, readers get the impression that the church is a replacement, theocracy. The church should become state. That is not what he means. Instead, what Augustine means is that we need a new definition for how we think about republics, one which admits of no degree, a kind of absolute eternal republic, in which everyone gets their due, including God, eternally. That's one standard for a republic that we should have, and we'll call that City of God. But then we should have another standard for a republic, which we won't call City of Man or City of God. We won't call it either of those things. We'll just have a vision of a republic which admits of degrees between them. On a scale which may move closer to the City of God or further away from the City of God. And in this way, the Christian can be a judge, a political judge of politics. The Christian can be a judge who looks at whether or not a republic is moving up or down. His alternative definition comes in 1924. The new definition of a republic counters Cicero's, or supplements it, if you prefer. It is that a republic is, quote, an association of rational beings. He roots it in our nature. An association of rational beings. We are all rational beings here. United by a common agreement about our common objects about the objects of love. An association of rational beings united by a common agreement on the objects of their love. That's an interesting way of putting the scale. Now he's transformed the individualism and rooted us in nature and directed us towards a common agreement about what our highest loves are. And that is what we should think about in terms of defining our politics. A whole range of possibilities now arise for naming better and worse kinds of political community through the category of love. As he puts it, the better the objects of agreement, the better the people. The worse the objects of this love, the worse the people. This fits the overall pattern, then, of relativizing politics in the Western dynamic to a middle position between the social and ecclesial and between the natural and the supernatural. The church remains the only truly comprehensive order, but this does not deny an integrity to many kinds of political community. Augustine makes repeated claims which indicate a preference for smaller scaled polities, and yet he also recognizes that God uses empires for the spread of the gospel. At times he expresses a kind of preference for monarchy, preference even for Christian kings. He writes, "We Christians call rulers happy if they rule with justice." Justice is the key standard for Augustine in adjudicating a polity. If they put their power in the service of God's majesty to extend his worship far and wide, if they do not fail to offer their true God as a sacrifice for their sins, the oblation of humility, compassion, and prayer, it is Christian emperors of this kind whom we call happy, happy in hope during this present life, and happy in reality hereafter, when we wait for what will come to pass. That's from Book 5, Chapter 24. Yet he also sees that Christian rule isn't always possible in this present life, and it can go badly as well. As a bishop who intervened in politics when it threatened the unity of the Catholic faith, he also understood that the political order can be useful to the peace of the church. Augustine believes that a good commonwealth can take various political forms, but that it cannot be good unless its loves and liberties are rightly ordered to the truth. In this way, all politics is personal for Augustine, but not individual. All politics move us to act, and if they move us to act in ways which do not accord with our common nature and with God, they are politics which necessarily will degrade us. This is why he sees as the church as essential to the flourishing of any particular commonwealth, because it is only through conversion to Christ that the soul, the city, and cosmos can be purified and perfected over time for the well-being of all humanity. Some concluding thoughts. One of the great risks of our times, I think, is that we're witnessing a revival of the pagan city, a revival of a sense in which our partisan politics overwhelm us and is the total comprehensive thing. Right? That's a pagan thing. For us to be pulled in the direction in which politics is totalizing is, in a sense, a reversal of the Christian relativizing principle in which politics takes a more middle position. This is precisely what Augustine thinks the city of man tends to do in history. This is how the city of man behaves, is it wants to expand its domain. This is how you can identify it. Once we begin to detach ourselves from nature to make it an instrument, a tool, a technology that we can use, once we think of nature as something we construct, once we think that we can make men into women, that we can call wicked acts good, we're pushing hard at the limits of nature. We want to expand the limits. We don't like the limits. And when we are pushing against the limits of nature, we're actually desiring the abolition of limits, which is precisely what the first fallen angel does too. That abolition of limits is precisely tied to the desire to abolish God, the highest good, and any truly common good, which could be found in a common nature as well as in Christ himself. We also seem to be unceasingly pushing to abolish the limits of our own distinct political forms. That we have little place for any common good in our society is evident in our tendency towards a kind of civic self-destruction. I suspect this is partly why we have come full circle in the West to admiring suicide again. Increasingly, euthanasia is becoming legal and even admirable. The Western dynamic has not seen this since pagan times. What suicide represents is this detachment from the good. And it doesn't only happen on an individual level. Nations and cities can commit a kind of existential suicide, and they do so by detaching themselves from their good. What is the good? What is our common good in this country? What does a substantive transcendent account of the common good offer our neighbors? Christians have a much higher citizenship, which frees them to speak and make political judgments about when a polity is going up or down and what it would take to require a kind of hydraulic lift for society. And this indeed is what the Christian, and the Catholic in particular, offers a society, is a vision, a exemplar, and sometimes a martyr who reminds a world which way is up and which way is down. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your lecture. We do have a lot of time for questions and answers, so if anyone has a question for Professor Peckerman, that's the time.
Do you have any thoughts? Thank you very much for your talk. That was fantastic. Thoughts on what a post-small L liberal social order would look like?
Well, it's going to happen. So when Manant says there's the modern and the ancient are not, the modern has not superseded the ancient. So what does he mean by that? Well, one thing he means is was yesterday Constitution Day? I've lost track of time. Constitution Day was celebrated recently. Constitution Day is a reminder of something ancient. Constitutions are an ancient idea, right? So if someone says, oh, well, there's liberalism is really political liberalism, small L liberalism, stemming from 16th, 17th century, is something which is the apotheosis of political knowledge. We can't get any higher than that. There are people who really think that. That is not an ancient idea, right? The ancients think republics are born, they have a life, and they die. That's an ancient idea. The ancient idea that republics are born and have a life and die is also rooted in the idea that they have constitutions both written and unwritten, right? That they have something which is constituting them. And I think this is writ into Augustine's idea of common objects of love. They have things that they love together. And they want to preserve those things that they love together and rightly order them. And that starts to constitute how you think about a polity. So whatever came after, let's say there's a possibility of thinking of something after. It's very difficult to think after what you're in. But if you could think that, one of the things you would have to think is that you would still need things like constitutions and order, right? I think there's a tendency to say, well, whatever comes after is going to be chaos. It's just, we are political by nature. We are going to order things by nature, right? And so I think that's one thing I would say to those who want to imagine some after-modern situation is remember that you're still going to need things like constitutions, like systems of law, which recognize something true about our nature, right? You're going to need a system which does justice to the dignity of every person. Right? You're going to need, these are things you're going to need, but you don't have to have them ordered in the way in which the Ciceronian modern does or the Lockean modern does. Right? You don't have to have that. You can. There's other ways of thinking and imagining how you order polities, because the polities will be ordered. We are ordering machines. Yes.
So, I believe we have remnants of Christendom in the Judeo-Christian values in our society, such as the inalienable dignity of the human person, the equality of persons, and a transcendent basis for law. So how can we, in a pluralistic context, how can we work with those of other beliefs or non-beliefs to reestablish, a higher order of love, a higher focus of those objects of love when we don't share the space?
So, you're right. The Augustinian ideal is something approaching a common agreement on the object of the love of God, right? This is, so what do we do when we find ourselves, we don't have that situation, right? We're not in a situation where where the triune God is the common object of all of our loves, right? That's, we can all agree on that. We don't have that. So Augustine says when you're in that, you have to try to, in a sense, find the highest common object of love. Instead of looking for the lowest common denominator, Augustine says, well, what's the highest common denominator you can go for? And see if you can start to locate that and see if there's a way that you can move that higher. Right? That he also sees that politics is something that can change. Right? That humans can act in ways which move politics in different directions. And so if you find yourself in a polity where you have Protestants, and this was, I think, our situation earlier in America, where you had Protestants and Jews, and not quite Muslims yet, but you had enough where you could say, well, let's just say God, the Deo Uno, is our highest common object. That was, I think, something like our settlement, our prior civil religion, had something like that as its. Now our civil religion is degrading. And so our civil religion now, I'm even afraid to say what our civil religion is now, but our civil religion now is, I think, moved at least two steps below that De Deo Uno kind of. But so the question then is being able to be the kind of judge who can say, okay, what are our, do we have highest objects? Like the person might be still a highest object. The person might still be the highest object of love. We love the person. We want to do dignity. We still want at our highest ideals. Maybe we're constantly having performative contradictions in the Kavanaugh hearings, for example. But we have performative contradictions aren't necessarily a bad thing because it still shows you what you love. So you could still say, well, we still have the person as highest love, and then you could begin saying, okay, well, could we have a polity which really truly enshrined the love of the person? What would that look like? And what would you need to do to reform your laws to conform to that highest object? Maybe you wouldn't want Roe v. Wade on your books if you had a standard like that, right? So that's how Augustine wants to think about this middle term of definition. It's like there's a kind of realist in Augustine who wants to just say, okay, what's our situation? How can we move the needle up? He's not a theocrat who wants to take a city by force. Yes, sir.
So Augustine was writing at a time of pluralism where there were many, many different religions and many different people around. And then,
thank you for saying that. People forget. Yeah. People think we're so pluralistic. We're not the most pluralistic.
Yeah, stuff,
way more pluralistic than we are.
Yeah. And
we're like lapsed Protestants as a nation. It's like, come on.
And you're falling out of Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, the politics that actually developed was feudalism and eventually tyrannies, serfs, I mean, all kinds of politics that we would certainly think were not very attractive now. Manette was writing in 1924 between World War One and World War Two, also maybe not the highest hour for Western.
Manon's living today. He's a more contemporary figure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Probably a different Manon you're thinking of.
But certainly the 20th century...
he's old, not that old.
Yeah. I'm old. I'm a 20th century guy. 20th century politics was certainly not that great in its consequences for people.
No, a disastrous century, really.
Yeah. So... we have a vision of the city of God of really, subsidiarity and ecclesiastic and
mm-hmm.
political and social, which all seems very naturally ordered, very beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and that our ability to put it into practice seems very limited in historical circumstances.
Well, I mean, in defense of Christendom, I would simply say it was in particular is a mixed bag. But in the broad spectrum, I think it was more capable of moving bad polities up a scale. Can I put it that way? So that Venice at certain points was really admirable, or Ravenna was really admirable, and another city was falling down the scale. So. I think one of the things that gives us certain advantages is when you knew what the eternal standards were, when you knew the transcendent standards, it was easier to pull a people up a scale. When you don't know the standards, it's very difficult to pull a people up a scale because you don't even know you're on a scale. So in the big picture, I prefer the medieval view, even though you're right, there's particular instances of polities done badly. Father, you had your hand up earlier.
You kind of were talking about the notion that, what's the highest good in our, the thing that we all love the most. I wouldn't say the person, I was going to say self-determination or something.
Sure, some value.
And then the way we're going is we're kind of critiquing, like our politics say, self-determination is, we kind of don't want to get rid of that, but we
mm-hmm.
want there to be something more,
mm-hmm.
and that could be just, health, or, we have this big problem, the environment, which is the common good in some broader
mm-hmm.
sense, and so even our self-determination goes against the environmental goods, then maybe we can critique self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
But their politics are going different directions as self-determination, which was held up for briefly as the thing,
mm-hmm.
seems to be breaking down.
It just occurs to me, you saying that, is there something deep in the philosophical tradition that Augustine draws from on actually wanting to purify concepts? So, like, if you have a concept like self-determination, Augustine's trained to think, okay, well, self-determination is totally insufficient as a perfection term. So what's the perfection term for self-determination? And then say, okay, well, the perfecting term would be something, the perfection term would be something like God's own creative act, right? God's own creative act is the perfection term for self-determination. So now you have a concept, and now you can see what its perfection term was. Then you could begin to think about what does it mean for us to value self-determination, and what can we move that value towards? And it gives you a kind of I think it gives you a way of thinking about, a different way of thinking about how you can move your political conversations away from the partisan rancor and towards, okay, what is it we really value? What is it we really love? And is there a way that we could push that to a more perfect, I was going to say in Lincoln's terms, a more perfect union, but a more perfect term, a more perfect terminus for what it is we're aiming at. And that is not something you hear in our discourse. We don't seem to want to aim at a more perfect term or a more perfect union. We seem to be aiming at political entropy. And maybe that's our fate. Maybe we are at the end of something. And if we are, then we need to think, we need to be in the place in which we're constantly thinking what would be the next beginning, a new beginning for America. Or we need to say, America has the resources to be renewed. But then where would that renewal come from? And what are the sources of renewal? So you either way, you have to be thinking the way Augustine wants you to think, which is, what are the loves and how do you turn them in the right direction? How do you move the loves towards their perfection term? Yes, sir.
The American society, for instance, in particular, seems to be the juxtaposition of two negative qualities, namely partisanism and pluralism, and that seems contradictory. But it seems like our society is essentially structured around a bunch of small groups, and you have to find your clique and then stick with them. But then when there's conflict between different cliques, then you have to ignore those differences and try to find some sort of commonality among all the different cliques.
Mm-hmm.
So as a Christian who tries to... So for instance, like even, you know, our bipartisan voting system, we basically only have two options for how to cast our vote for society, and neither of them presents a perfect picture of how God would like society to be ruled.
Right.
And so how do we as Christians avoid either of those traps of partisanism or pluralism?
Well, I mean, for one thing, bearing witness to what you just said, saying, I mean, in a, if you, this is a dramatic example, but I love the example of the martyr, because the martyr is someone who is always standing against what everybody else is doing, and yet their very standing against is something which will eventually move the society. You know, the martyr is killed, and at some point there's a recognition that, even if it's a historical recognition, that that was unjust. Right, and so I think there's a sense in which the Christian must stand up and say, "These aren't the choices that fit with our political nature, our political goods. We need different choices. We need to think more carefully about how we're ordering our society." And I think the Christian should be the first one who stands up to say that, to say that our order is schizophrenic, our order is disordering. And it's disordering us. It's disordering our political nature, and we're not going to take it anymore. You know, it's a different kind of protest, I think. We're all used to the signs for this, that, and the other thing, but it's not a real political protest. It's just theater. And that the better protest is the one that says, "No, I want metaphysics. No. I want a metaphysical basis for understanding the human person. I want a metaphysical basis for understanding what is our common nature. What is the proper ordering for that nature?" That's the right kind of protest.
See, my concern for that is that if people get grouped into the "I want a metaphysical society," then everyone else will just perceive them as, "Oh, this is another clique. These are the religious nutbags clique."
Yeah.
So how do you avoid being put into that box that prevents you from acting? Because it seems like the overall goal of American society is to ignore our other partisan groups, or essentially to try to like smooth over all the differences and be like, "Okay, so you guys believe this thing and you guys believe this thing. Let's try to find some sort of like aggregate that like sort of makes everybody happy."
I think in a sense, to present the most comprehensive and compelling vision that you can and not worry how it turns out. That is, not worry how... If the system is going to absorb you into its Borg-like structure, then it does. But in a sense, that's not reality. Its Borg-like system is false. And so the pointing it out is, I think, the greatest charity that you can give, is to say, "This is a false ordering that's not good for you. It's not making your society happier. I think we can do better." And if you get put in a box for saying that, if I get put in a box for saying that, so be it. I think there's truth liberates us. Just telling the truth about things is a good thing, and people can disagree with you. I have no plan for political action. I will never have plans for political action. I actually think contemplation of the reality is actually the action. Yes?
You were to say it briefly, what is it about our politics that makes it so that what we call politics is contrary to our true political nature?
What is it about it?
Yeah, what is it?
I
mean, you can, you know, you spoke about the sort of tribal mm-hmm. partisanship, but what is it that is leading to this anti-political politics?
What's leading to the anti-political politics, or where does it derive from?
Yeah, and one question I have in particular is something true to our political nature possible in a country as large as ours on a national level?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. Those are two different kinds of questions. Let me answer your first one theologically, and then I'll try to answer it politically. Theologically, you can't explain evil. Theologically, wickedness doesn't have a causal explanation, because wickedness is always a privation of a good. Right? So if you ask me, where does the anti-political tendency come from? I'll say from nothing. It comes from nothing, and it comes to us because we're created out of nothing, and it's a kind of fall back into the nothing. Right? And so I can't answer your question, strictly speaking. That being said, one can see signs. One can see correlative effects, right, consequences. And I pointed to some of them as to what is anti-political about our culture. What's anti-political about our culture is that if you go into a family, the most important thing on Thanksgiving is to avoid all the topics that divide the whole family politically, right? That our politics is so disordering that it causes strain and tension on families is a really good sign of a negative correlative effect, right? That you can't talk to Uncle Bob because he watches Fox News or whatever. Is a really intimate sign that something about our politics disorders the basic structures, the basic goods, right? So that's more political effects or consequences of something that's disordering. The second question about are we too big? This is a conversation that goes right back to the American founding about the states being the proper scale. And that those who opposed having a large United States were shouted down. And so they all said scale matters, right? You scale up, this is going to be really hard to maintain a commonwealth. That's a pretty strong Christian tradition. Augustine also prefers the small polity. Aristotle prefers the small polity. So it's a really good point. The trick of the founders was to claim that, well, we're all going to have our small polities, but we're going to be allied to each other in a united configuration of small polities, right? But we lost that vision, and so states are just like administrative, procedural ways of delivering the wishes of a federal government. So we have the scale problem. The founders did try to accommodate the problem, but I don't think it worked.
Professor, I think yes. We have time for one last question.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Yeah, kind of just going off that question, I'm wondering what the importance of geographical size plays into your notion of small, because on the notion of polity that you shared with us at Augustine as, shared
common good, shared love for the common good. Mm-hmm. Seems like that's not something that has to be geographically bound. So just wondering your thoughts on the importance of geography and inequality, I guess. Yeah, I mean, the virtue of patria is this attachment to the land and the attachment to the land of your fathers. I think there's something to that. I want to say yes and no to that yes, geography and spatial limits matter. I think Augustine is sympathetic to that, but he would say, but look at the Roman Empire and how good it was for Christianity. It spread all over, past all geographical, rational geographical limits, and it was providential. Maybe it's not the best kind of structure for preserving a genuinely common good in which everyone's participating in a common good, but look what God did with it. So it's like, I think there's a realism there too, which is to say, yes, on paper you're right. The Aristotelian mean is right here, right? But in practice, you're going to have big empires, and they big empires occur in history, and God uses them somehow, either as negative examples by which Christianity is contrasted against, or as persecutor of Christianity, or as an aid to Christianity, as he says all three of those things about the Roman Empire. So again, he's able to provide you with the pure vision, as well as with a standard for saying, okay, well, just also pay attention to the givens and what you have before you and how you can move things and how you can see God acting through those things. God can act in America.
All right, why don't we give our speakers a hand?